Hi, I'm delighted to be here. It's nice to get a trip almost home, but a fair distance, fair length of the distance anyway. I wanted to talk this evening, try and hit a number of issues, and then hopefully in questions we can get into deeper in some of those issues. But one of the questions that often comes up for us is a question that people pose and say, why is the church so worried about communications? And there's an easy answer to that, a first and obvious answer, which is the church ultimately was founded, we believe, to be a communication community. We believe the church was sent here, put here, to communicate the good news of the gospel. So communication is an integral part of who we are and what we're about, although occasionally we have to remind bishops of that and that they should be giving more priority to this as part of what they're doing. But globally, the church has very significant resources. Radios, newspapers, a developing web presence, TV stations, some parts of the world. But more particularly, I would say the resources has wonderful people who are very, very good, competent communicators who are doing a huge amount of work on the church's behalf in the area of communications. And one of our roles is to advocate for them, support them, encourage them, and kind of get them networking. Second, and perhaps more important in some ways, but thoroughly related part of our work is to encourage reflection within the church, but also outside the church, on the contribution of communications to the development of human society. Communication is fundamental to how in societies we grow together, whether we are going to have societies that are united, that are cohesive, societies that are inclusive, or societies that are not inclusive, will be very often determined by our capacities to communicate. When we look at some of the global problems we have to confront in our world today, we think of climate change, we think of issues of food shortage, we think of illnesses of various types. Are we going to approach them collaboratively, sharing knowledge, communicating well with one another, or is it going to be pursuing our own interests? And these are fundamentally questions which communications will determine. And therefore, we have that interest in being part of that debate. And the two tasks are related. I think that our task of being people who proclaim the good news, who share the insights of the gospel, I think they are insights that will help to build up a more just society. Also, by virtue of being people who are called to belief in Christ, who have been gifted with that, who are inviting other people to understand and to share the joy of that same faith, we're not exempted either from the concerns of the world. So we have to be part of the larger discussions, the larger debates. The World Communications Day message is a tradition now going back almost 50 years. And it's an occasion in which the Pope addresses communications in a systematic kind of thematic way. The audiences, the primary audience, and this I think an important thing is, it's not a message just for Catholics. It's a message for everybody. Because communications is an inclusive activity. We can't be making it just a sectional interest. Communications will determine very much our capacity to be a community. We also think that the message is one that obviously is of particular interest for specialists, for professional communicators, believers and unbelievers alike. That distinction between with social media, the distinction between the producer and the consumer is going, so we're all more and more also producers of media. We're not simply there consumers of media, so therefore I think the specialists is a broader category. But all then, there's a message then specifically to believers, where the Pope may occasionally want to encourage those who are listening in a particular way to his word to respond and to encourage their interest in this area. In the last 7-8 years, the themes of the messages have all focused more or less in and around the whole, what we might call the digital revolution. There's a concern for the church to think again about how are we going to communicate in an environment that has been radically changed by what we're living through at the moment. And then there's that concern particularly about, will this great revolution, this great change in communications, be something that's really a benefit to all people? Pope Benedict, in his first message when he spoke extensively on this topic, was very clear on one thing, and that was on the need for inclusivity. And he drew attention to the fact that the traditional exclusions caused by poverty could become even wider if people were going to be excluded from the networks where knowledge was shared, where commerce happened, where development and education took place. So this focus on inclusivity. Pope Francis this year has, the first time he's spoken directly as Pope on the theme of communications. He's addressed it in a number of other moments, but the first systematic kind of reflection. And his ideas, and the language is changing, but I think the concern is much the same. And he's bringing a concern about how can communication serve to promote an authentic culture of encounter. If you've been watching or listening or reading about Pope Francis, this theme, the culture of encounter, is very close to his heart. In the message this year, he begins with an obvious point. He says, in some way, communication is making this a much smaller world. The globalized economy, transport, communications means it's a village. And yet, he says, the distances between those who are marginalized and those who are not, between those who have power and those who don't, are becoming greater than ever. So the paradox is, can we then see a way in which communication can help us to bridge some of those gaps? And developing this theme he calls the culture of encounter. I'll be coming back to that theme repeatedly, but what does he mean by the culture of encounter? It's a kind of a countercultural idea for him. He talks about the dominant culture, and he uses a term at times, economic humanism, a kind of a culture that's based on people having to prove their worth, that divides, where there can be rejection, where there can be marginalization. And whatever the culture of encounter is, it's not that. At a social level, I think it's calling for a greater sense of solidarity, a sense of that we are one family, that we have responsibilities for each other, and he uses the term solidarity. But then he uses this term that we have problems at times translating, sarsenia, which nearness, closeness, neighborliness. But it's saying that this change that's going to have to come around, this culture of encounter, isn't just an idea, but it's going to call for a change within people. That the radicalness of this nearness, this closeness, it's not just that I, in a general way, yes, we're all brothers and sisters. No, I have that sense when I see the bystander, when I see the drunk, when I see the person who's been left behind. So it's breaking from theory and coming close to the reality of our people. This is move quickly, I think, here. We talk about the digital world. And just a couple of things that have been emerging in the messages for the last few years. One is, there's been rightly a lot of focus on whether people wanted to call it an IT revolution or a transformation, and theorists debate this. But the change, very often we're most captured by the technological change. So I carry with me now a device that can do all sorts of things that were unimaginable 30 years ago. And it's going to get smaller, quicker, faster, less costly, more inclusive, more networked as time goes by. At least that's the presumption we work on. But the really interesting changes are not, and I don't do technology, but it's the cultural changes. It's how my nephews and nieces are growing up in a very different world to the world I grew up in. I was going to say 30, but make it 40 years ago. And they are learning differently. They're gathering information very differently. Whatever news they may be getting, they're getting it differently. Their way of expressing themselves is changing. And then, very radically and very importantly, I think, the way in which they form relationships, maintain relationships and friendships, and build community has been radically changed. State the obvious, I left a secondary school in 1975 in the west of Ireland. I have seen maybe 5 or 6 people out of a graduation year of 160. Nowadays, people are going to be connected. They're going to be networked. it's not all bad necessarily losing some of the people along the way. And that was one of the things, I must say, one of my first escapades into Facebook, I saw all these people who wanted to re-establish, and I was going, no, no, no. Anyway, enough. But this is the change. And the change is also something that's happening. The British government had a very interesting Forsyth report on identities, where they said, what's the big determination of identity for young people today? And they would argue it's a preliminary report, and that social media is perhaps even more important than religion, ethnicity, job, or age in determining identity today. So this is something crucial for us as a church who's interested in how people form their identity, how they form community, how they relate to each other. The second point, and these are a couple of little things we say, we ban the word new media in our office. We're not supposed to say new media because that's giving the age away. And this is ordinary, everyday reality for me, for a lot of the people here, but it's relatively new to me. But what we do want to appreciate is the newness. There is a dynamic, a different dynamic in communications now relative to the type of dynamics we were used to in the past. That is ongoing. We don't know where it's going to end. Nobody can tell you where all this is going because it's not the companies, it's not the governments decides, it's the users. Also, we can't step outside of it all and just watch it all and let's step back and analyze it because it's we're there. We're being changed, our engagement. So we don't have that bird's eye view. We're not outside this reality. Another little thing we like to hammer home, this idea of saying the digital is real. That's particularly for a lot of our stakeholders, if we use that. Senior employers within my organization, if I use the corporate speak, who are older and who don't necessarily see this as something hugely important. It's a toy, it's a gimmick, it's a fad, it could pass. One say, no, this is real. This is an increasingly important dimension of the lives of so many people, and not just young people, and not just in the developed world. So therefore, one of the things we want to say is, if the church isn't present in the digital arena, we're going to be absent from an increasingly important dimension of people's lives. That's where the Pontifex project came from. Its substantive value, yes, it does allow us to send short messages of hope and inspiration and encouragement to people, or allows the Pope to do it, and each message is coming from the Pope. But, and that's, there's 14 million people choosing to take that, and they in turn, there's a significant retweet element there, which gets interesting because then it's arriving into people who didn't sign up for it but might be struck by something, and that's important in itself. But more importantly is it says to all sorts of people, this is significant. You need to think as a bishop or as a religious order or as a person about how you're going to be present, because it's not just passing, so it's real. Try to avoid the dualism. This is the one that we get all the time. Real and virtual, online, offline. They're seamless for many people. It's an enhanced kind of communication. It's an enhanced way of being. We need to maybe analyze that more, and there's criticisms to be made, but we need to avoid the dualism. Final one is the observation we keep thing is saying, my traditional way of thinking, and I don't have a communications background, I have no formal training in the area, but I'm trying to think, communication is all about the instruments I use to communication. The microphone, the camera, the video. But it's actually what's much more interesting nowadays is there your point of access into a kind of a conversation, into an environment that is constituted also by others. So we need to get beyond this traditional way, how am I going to use communications or how am I going to use communications instruments? And the more effective question is, what's my style of presence going to be? How are we going to be present in this new environment, in this new ambience that has been created by the emerging digital tools? And I'd like to pick up here just two words that, two little things I'm taking from Pope Francis, where he talks about it, but they're classic things in some ways. First thing he says to in the message this year, he has this idea, and he says to believers, to be citizens of a digital world, to be citizens. Important thing there is we're not citizens on our own. We're citizens with others. And this is, I think, an invitation on behalf of the Pope, is for all of us, believers and non-believers alike, to begin to take up the civic duties, the responsibilities, that privilege brings. If we're people who have access to these means of communication, then it brings with us, brings for us, I think, a responsibility to reflect on the sort of society that's going to emerge, how they're going to contribute or not contribute to human well-being. The kind of limit question, this coming up, is social media, are the various social media, are they good or bad? There was probably at the beginning a non-critical phase where they were going to be wonderful. The whole world was going to be democratized. We were all going to grow in learning. We were all going to grow in sharing and understanding and tolerance because we would have this wonderful flourishing of social media. Now we're getting the kickback. So we're all going to become more stupid. We're going to become shallow. We're going to become isolated psychologically. We're going to become asocial. Somewhere in there, I think, there's a happy balance. In terms of the choice of the popes, it's been interesting, and this is particularly Pope Benedict, was very strong. I remember the time in the background of his briefing in this, when he saw the level of knowledge that could be brought close to so many people. He was the one who came out with this term about 7-8 years ago. He said, look, this is a gift for humanity. And in his message this year, Pope Francis says, it's a gift from God. So, are we being naive? Are we being a little bit, no. I mean, there's an awareness of, there's a downside in terms of the use some people will put social media to manipulate, to bully, to harass, to exploit. Yeah, there's the tone of a lot of social media that can be worrying. And then there are maybe more worrying people, is there a fundamental addictive quality there sometimes? Let's not be naive, but let's also realize that the problem is not the technologies. And this is the thing that Pope Francis says this year. He says, look, communications is ultimately not a technological, but a human achievement. So how are we going to be part, not exclusively, but believers, how are we going to be part of an effort by the community, by other responsible users? And I don't want to sound like the adult in the playground. This is about how are we going to ensure that, yes, the communication will be good. One thing, term we've often heard the term user-generated content, but there's also user-generated culture. The culture of social media is, in a sense, determined by the people. It's the people who are present who will make that culture either good or bad. And that's one of the things when Pope Benedict goes on Twitter and there's immediately bang, 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 and all sorts of negative reactions and people saying, you have to get out of it, you can't be there, that's not where the church should be. Okay, what are we doing then? We're leaving that space to the bullies and the trolls and the others. We want people of goodwill to be there, to humanize it, for all of us. The question of agency comes in here. Very often, I know in my country, very often, the government has to do something, or the international organizations. There's limits to what they can do, even where there is the goodwill. The companies have to do more. Again, let's also come back to the question of individual responsibility. The culture will be determined very significantly by individual choices, by people like you and me, who are present in varying ways in social media. I would like to just quickly move here to an idea that I want to try. Okay, what does that responsibility look like? What are the kind of attitudes, values that we should have if we want to have a thoroughly social, in the truest sense of the word, media that builds up society and that helps individuals to flourish? Again, part of the idea is here, it's not about looking to somebody to impose rules, to come in with a new set of guidelines. It's actually more for us to see, can we articulate on the basis of what we believe this should be doing and the basis of its potential for good, can we begin then to articulate some intrinsic values, an intrinsic ethic? There was a great effort of this in an extreme, probably before digital media had really emerged, by Honora Neal in the Reith lectures about 9-10 years ago, where she talked about trust. And she said, look, media is fundamental for the functioning of democracy. If we can't trust media to do their work well, and I think the term was, we're going to poison the wells of public discourse. Because I can't make informed choices about politics, about commerce, about other things, if I'm not being fed honest, reliable, trustworthy information. So that's not anybody imposing, it's just saying it's not doing its job, it's not realizing its potential if it's not trustworthy. So I think, again, some of the values and attitudes that I think we need and that we have to hold ourselves to and invite other people to think about would be, if it's going to be social, there has to be respect. Bullying and harassment will not make an environment social. They'll drive some people out and they'll make other people worse, and it can't work. Honesty, objectivity, reasonableness. I think reasonableness is important. Very often a lot of the arguments in social media are presumably won by numbers. What about the quality of arguments? The fact that somebody can be sensational or somebody can have an impact doesn't necessarily mean they have the best arguments. I think openness, Cass Sunstein, who's working in the United States, has been very strong on the capacity of media to polarize, increasingly. I follow my media. I live in my little cocoon. I only listen to people who tell me how right I am in everything I think. And we're in information silos, so we can't actually engage. So somehow, can we get into a kind of an openness? Am I willing to explore the views of people who are different, who challenge me, who don't see it my way? Could I learn from them? And then kind of a fairly radical listening. Are we just there to, or can we listen? One little for professionals, and that term, as I say, is more problematic nowadays because we're all engaged. But traditionally, I think journalists had a very strong ethical sense. Okay, some of the stuff, the bad stuff we've seen over the last few years gives us reason to be concerned, but don't forget, to this day, there are journalists who are dying. There are martyrs of people who will risk their own lives rather than ignore a story, rather than let a government do what it wants to do in a hidden way, rather than turn a blind eye to some commercial company's activities in some part of the world that doesn't have the type of protections we have. And there are people giving their lives. And let's navigate by that. It's easy to condemn what's abusive. Let's try and recall people to that noble instinct to be people who speak truth to power. I think on that one, just two little reflections on it. One is, the martyrdoms are dramatic. But what about the person who is trying to hold high standards in an office where speed is the name of the game, and you won't be liked if you're saying, I want to check a fact, or I want to come back? Or somebody who's saying, there's another view we have to take into account there, which may not be to the liking of the owner or controller of where they're working. So I do think journalists themselves and professionals working in media need to keep alive that sense and hold each other to the highest standards. One of the great definitions of a profession is, it's not about that I aspire to the highest standards, but I hold other people who have that title to the same standards. Pope Benedict, again, to a group of people who were working with in the formation of journalists, used a phrase, he said, bring up future journalists and help them to have a kind of methodological skepticism. Yeah, just ask the hard question, but don't ever let that become a kind of routine cynicism, where everything is just dismissed. The culture of encounter in that one, I think, is again saying to us, if we want the inclusivity, if we want the debates to be meaningful, then we need this sense of, for me, part of the culture of encounter applied to communication is the other matters. The other person's views are important. The other person is not just a means or something I use to achieve my predetermined aims and ambitions. The other person is important. I give worth, I give value to the other person. The term relationships, which is a term that had been used before, relationships can be ambiguous. Some are good, some are not good. But the encounter is to meet the other person, to value the other person for who he or she is, to allow them to become themselves, rather than simply to want them to fit my pattern, my plan, my ideas. And therefore, at the host of this, and it's explored at depth by the Pope, is this idea of dialogue. And that dialogue is about listening with sympathy, with a desire to understand so I can learn about the other. So I learn about his or her arguments, I learn about his or her concerns, and then I can share my own. But I share my own meaningfully because I have listened. I may come to appreciate my own better sometimes by listening to another person. But one of the things I think we have to watch is dialogue is not a tactic. There's all sorts of companies are fantastic at engagement online and media engagement, but are they really interested? One thing is dialogue. And I think for Christians, for believers, but not just for believers, but for believers in a particular way, our authenticity, the credibility of the kind of views we express of our faith will be demonstrated by our behavior. Are we really interested? Are we just pushing? Are we another company with a product to sell? Or actually, are we interested in people? Or are they there just as kind of fodder for our ecclesial imperialistic ambitions? But are we genuinely interested in the person? Or are we just trying to, like so many others in this space, sell something? And that's a bit rough, but I think you might know what I have there. Believers. This is part of a more specific thing is, again, as believers, we can talk about a shared task. Believers, not on their own, but in common with others, have this, I think, a responsibility for the culture, for the strength of the social media environment. One term that was used by Pope Benedict that can be problematic, but I think it could also be a very rich one, is he talked about giving a soul to the internet. That doesn't mean believers are the soul, that we're the only people with an interest in the deeper questions, in the limit questions, in the questions of ultimate value. But what we're trying to do is, can we make a space in social media where people can risk, can be honest, can explore deeper questions? So can we, with others, create this safe place where people can show their vulnerability, can expose themselves, can be willing to engage at a more meaningful level? Because a lot of what's happening on the internet is people are going with questions. Search is one of the drivers. People have questions. Some are trivial, some are more profound. But when you question anything, if you put a question on the internet, first thing usually comes back are commercial solutions. Somebody's selling you a product, an idea, a methodology, an ideology, a vision. No. Are they willing to listen to your question? And Pope Benedict suggested that for Christians, the specific form of witness, the way we would witness to our faith as opposed to simply speaking it, would be by taking others seriously, by taking their questions seriously, by allowing them to go, to give them the time, to give them the level of interest that shows a concern for people, and that the specific form of witness, the way we would best, in a sense, make known the gospel, not necessarily through explicit presenting of Catholic truths or faiths, but through our attentiveness, our engagement with, our giving time, our taking seriously of other people. And that's a thing that Pope Francis has taken up with this idea of the pilgrim. He says we need to journey with other people. Life is a journey. We need to bring them with hope. And in that context, if a conversation emerges with another person, if a conversation goes that little bit deeper, that's the context in which it may be appropriate then for us to share the source of our joy and our hope, share our faith, share our belief. Not because I'm going to push a view, but because this is something that is so important to me, that is something that gives me such security and worth in my life that I want to share it with others. Just one quick quote from Pope Francis here, and he said, okay, he talks about sharing faith, but he says, do so without being presumptuous. Do so without imposing our truths, but rather be guided by the humble yet joyful certainty of those who have been found, touched, and transformed by the truth, who is Christ, ever to be proclaimed. We share something that's of value, that enhances our lives, that in neighborliness we want to share with others, not to impose, not to manipulate, but to share something of value. Back to this neighborliness idea again, which Pope Francis uses And this is the attempt to translate this idea of nearness, closeness, neighborliness, which is more than simply citizenship. It's going that little bit extra. And it's about, again, the closeness to the other, to the image then the Pope in his message picks up very much in the notion of the Good Samaritan, the one who doesn't ignore the stranger, the problem maker, the difficulty on the margins of his life. The Good Samaritan who's marked by compassion. It's not just, I have an intellectual answer to this problem. The Good Samaritan who reaches out. Today's tweet from the Pope, pure coincidence, I assure you, says we're all to be like the Good Samaritan. We're not to be ashamed to touch wounds in order to heal, and to heal with concrete acts of love. The Good Samaritan is, we're gone beyond theory. It's call, it's direct, it's human. And I think, important one for us here, Pope is clearly saying to the Christians, to the believers, who, or to anybody who wants to listen to him, we should be imitating the Good Samaritan. But I think he's also saying we should be able to recognize the Good Samaritan, because the Good Samaritan was the non-licensed outsider who didn't belong to the religious community, who did the right thing. And it's our capacity to see and understand the goodness, the value, the worth, the contributions of others who maybe don't share a lot of our presuppositions or who we mightn't normally like. Part of the power of the Good Samaritan is it's the unexpected outsider who does the meaningful and proper thing. So I'm going to move very quickly now. I'll take 5 minutes. I'm moving into stuff that's maybe more familiar to some of you, but one thing here is about a particular challenge for the churches. How do we find a language with which to engage? We talked about language at the Mass this evening, but how do we find a language that enables us to engage? And here I think we have to relearn. Our tradition in the church, we're used to one-way broadcasting. The microphone, the relatively captive audience, the relatively captive community. TV allowed us, they could see us now as well as hear us. Radio allowed us, the internet. A lot of our thinking can be that. But the digital media is more conversational, it's participative, it's interactive. And that's a style that's going to be different for us. And that's a real challenge. But I think part of that is, say, even the Pope's Twitter account. Pope is tweeting, but he's not engaging. It would be difficult, logistically. But can other people within the church take the responses that are coming in, look at the kind of questions people are asking, and engage with that meaningful, so that we do get a church that's interactive, that's participative, and that actually is a good model of the church, because the church isn't just the Pope in Rome. The church is all of us. So one is to try and put the jargon, a devolved interactivity. So next one is modes. In the church, we have a long tradition of expressing ourselves with well-written texts. Letters, encyclicals, pastoral letters, and they sit on websites around the world, and some of them are only magnificent, but they tend to sit there. We're dealing with people who aren't reading in that same way. We need, I think, to move beyond the text. I know I'm preaching to the converted here in terms of the Bishop's Conference here on the importance of images and the use of images, but broadening out from that the tradition of beauty within our church. We can get beyond text. We shouldn't be text dependent. Vocabulary. Increasingly the words we use are difficult. Pope Francis, giving out in a sense to bishops, said we need to reacquire what he called a grammar of simplicity. If we can't say it in language that other people understand, it's probably because we haven't really understood it. We can hide behind theology at times, we can hide behind theoretical ideas, and social media has that about it. You're engaging and somebody fires the question, and it's like the old one to Peter, but who do you say that I am? I don't want a reference or another article. I want to hear you on this. I'll move through that there now quickly. Part of this I'm going to say is, this isn't simply about what we do. Our presence, our being citizens, our being believers, our finding a language with which we speak. But it also begins for believers with conversion. And by conversion, I think we're back to the actual encounter we ourselves have had with Christ, which has made us a believer, and which is the thing that will be most likely to guarantee the authenticity of our presence. So Pope Francis, when he talks about the culture of encounter, for believers, he's saying, you're born from an experience of being loved by God, being graced by God, and that's what you ultimately want to share. You will only do that authentically and well if you're allowing that message to change you, to challenge you, to push you beyond your comfort zone. Therefore, I think one of the things within our tradition we need to reflect on the Bible, the Gospels, so that those words become spontaneous for us. So the attitudes and the values of Christ, not just something we have to think about and imitate, but they formed us so that our actions, our way of being, comes from who we are. Part of that is about silence and solitude. But silence and solitude, not as a kind of worried sometimes when people kind of talk about going on digital diets and removing yourself from social media and somehow stuff. No. Silence and solitude can also be fostered in the digital space. It's about having time for reflection and not always answering and flying. I take time to respond. Listening can only begin in silence. The other one here, and I think it's the old gospel idea that you turn the other cheek. In the digital space, I think that needs to be acquired with a newfound, you're where you're watching, and by God, I want to go in there and I have the right answer. And it's that, I'm not going to be brought down by the level of debates. The old Oscar Wilde, you love your enemies, they'll hate you for it. That sort of somehow there. But it's more seriously, it's about the culture. We challenge the culture, and it's about our own authenticity. Another thing for people who work as Catholic communicators, some of you do, one thing I think we always have to do is we have to sense a trust in God. We have to be professional. We have to do our job as well as we can. But also we have to recognize that often God has God's own way of finding a space in human hearts that sometimes bypasses, thankfully, our so-called best efforts. We do our best, we don't be complacent, but we recognize we're dealing with an area of mystery. Next one is convergence, which is more an institutional thing. We have all sorts of global resources as a church. We have all sorts of very interesting people with lots of various relevant skills, from filmmaking to writing, to being able to identify good content and share that. We want to make of all of that a network. So convergence, not competition, has to be the hallmark of how as an institution we work in the field institutionally when we're involved in communication. We need to try new things, measure them. We need to learn from one another. One person's mistake can save somebody else making the same mistake. We need to have flexibility. The platforms keep changing. The Economist advice some months ago was that I thought it was very good. It says to people, managers looking at social media, it says, don't marry any platform, be promiscuous, try them all, but don't marry any one of them. Let's be free. We're working with Twitter. It may not be the relevant thing in a year's time. We find it logistically difficult for the moment to work with Facebook, but maybe it could become something. Who knows what tomorrow's... I was doing a thing recently, things that we take for granted now. Instagram, some of these, Pinterest, are 3 and 4 years old. Who knows what we're going to be? So we need that flexibility. We need to, and this is for a church, we're not necessarily sometimes a little risk adverse, we need to take risks, trust young people. The old Irish expression, Mullan Ogiorgus Chucky Sheed. Trust young people, give them authority, and they will not disappoint you. They will rise to it. This organic, again, there's no organic. It has to be organic. We can't have a master or a guru who's going to come in and tell us what we should do. The final point is just, and I'll leave on this one, is receptivity. Why I remain very hopeful, be it about the human side of this debate or be it about the church's engagement with social media. The thing that I find most interesting, I was reading an article and I was watching, they were talking about what are the drivers, what are the things that have made the big social media companies, what are the human emotions that have driven their success? Connectivity. People want connections with others. Facebook. People are searching. Google, Wikipedia. They're looking for information. They're looking for answers. People play. They want something playful. YouTube. That's at least my use of YouTube. Netflix. People are sharing, and this is a huge thing. People want to share photographs, share images, share their ideas, but more significantly, people are sharing their skills and their abilities, and they're moving away from the old idea of copyright and from the idea of companies owning technologies. And there's a noble instinct of people to want to contribute. So we get software programs being developed by people which are then free. We have this desire to follow the Twitter phenomenon, looking for guidance, looking for people. What I want to suggest is, humanly, there's a need here, I think, for an engagement with that. These, for me, are hugely significant and positive, that these are the fundamental values that are driving people. These are positive. Can we engage with them and bring out and accentuate the positive so that that whole desire for connection becomes friendship, authentic, full friendship, which isn't something you can measure. It's not about numbers. So can we ensure that that desire that people have for connectivity won't be somehow short-circuited into 457 friends, but that we can not try to belittle that, but let's re-achieve the sense of what a particular grace, blessing, whatever term you like to use, privilege, a true friend is. Truth, we're searching, but some answers are more dependable, are more verified, are more vindicated than others. It's not all just a matter of opinion. The playfulness, can it bring us into the realm of beauty? Can entertainment bring us into the kind of entertainment, the kind of play that liberates us and sets us free and nobilizes us and energizes us? The sharing, can that become self-giving? Because a lot of our sharing is a little bit exhibitionist. It's me showing off and my wonderful experience. But can that actually become the truer and ultimately very ennobling human experience of actually being able to help and make a difference to another person? And then this openness, where the following can be the closed little sector. I follow those I know, they're not going to surprise me. But can we broaden beyond that? And part of my instinct here is, I think that's in the human heart. We're wired for these activities. Maybe as a church this time we can look at it, there is a necessity to critique false gods. The wealth, the power, the fame are still the drivers, if we allow them to be. But we do that gently, speaking truth and love. The religious dimension, I think, the more I see the desire in people for human connectivity, the more I come back to Augustine's idea, only with God will my soul be at rest. That ultimate nostalgia, yearning, desire for community, desire to be loved, desire to be appreciated, is in our Catholic tradition, and not just a Catholic tradition, but many religious, is the beginning of something that can open a person towards an encounter with the God who loves unconditionally. And then the final part of this, and I'll leave on this one, is respect. What happens between an individual and his or her encounter with mystery, with God, is very privileged terrain. No manipulation. We have to be to respect it. This Pope Francis, to us, our council meeting last year, said, no manipulation, no engineering. Allow people the dignity of that encounter with God, trusting human nature and trusting God. Okay, thank you.